as a viewer to your cast. Okay, I think I caught a little bit there. There's still a lot of noise they can find on your signal. I think you mentioned corona holes, and different than sunspots. And the corona holes, I think this is what you're maybe talking about. They're areas. These are magnetic fields. There is a magnetic field where the solar wind is escaping, but it's also lower in, just dropping. There are lower production in UV and X-rays, radiation, than the surrounding area, which gives the impression that the area is cooler. So it's an area where you've got open magnetic field, and because of this, it's producing less ultraviolet and X-rays, and from that, it's getting a cooler appearance than the surrounding areas where this coronal hole is being produced. Along those open magnetic field lines out into space, and this forms a high-speed stream of solar plasma emanating from that coronal hole. Over.
Can you find a better spot to stand in?
How's this? Is it any better? Is this any better? Yeah, that's a bit better that time. Okay, so what I'm talking about... Because of the magnetic field, more or less open and extending out to... and any plasma... surface will get the system at large. At higher velocity than the local or sort of ambient solar wind velocity. Forms sort of like a spraying a hose of particles out into space as the sun rotates. Okay, I got some of that. I'm going to move on here in a sec. We can pick this up again in a little bit if you like to come in again. I'm just going to make a comment about the corona holes you're talking about. And yes, it's different from CME. They're not ejecting material the same as CME. CME is actually ejecting material from the sun's surface, and snapping it off, and it's traveling through space on its own. The coronal holes that you're talking about, they're ejecting magnetic field lines. Those magnetic field lines, they're screening particles, not in the same way as a CME is. It's not material. Solar material that's breaking off the solar surface and heading out into interstellar space or interplanetary space. These here are different than that. It's a cooler region. It's open lines of magnetic field. These magnetic fields are coming off the surface. They're spewing out these particles, charged particles like electrons, protons, helium, nuclei into space, which is a little bit different than CME. But they both can have much the same effect on Earth as far as producing geostorms here, interfering with electronics, causing aurora activity, things like that. CMEs are a little bit more violent.
Yes, agreed on everything you said there. The only thing I would like to add is that this coronal hole has survived multiple solar missions. I think it's in the tens of millions. And so a lot of that energy. October, and that'll be done talking about this so we can move on.
Okay. And this is VA3KEX. And as it was suggested a couple of moments ago, if you can find another spot and you can orientate yourself a little bit better, come on back in. A lot of noise in your signal and breaking up there a little bit back and forth. But I think from coming back and forth in to the net here, I was able to get most of what you're talking about with coronal holes and CME. And one final thing, and if you want to pick up again in a little while, come on in. Maybe closer to the end of that if you're still there and you want to come back in, is that the coronal holes, they are different. They are different in what they're producing, but they also do have influence. They also do have a lot of influence on CMEs, particularly in how CMEs are aimed, where they're going. So these coronal holes can have that influence. All right, let me just stop here, see if there are any additional check-ins or comments, and then we'll move on. And as I mentioned a little while ago, about an object at the very edge of our solar system. And it's been confirmed in initial studies, in fact, there's two studies. One has strengthened the confirmation of the previous one. And some interesting things there. And it's also helping the search for this Planet 9 that they've been looking for a very long time. This is the VA3KX.
Yeah, Control, this is Kilo 6, Alpha, Alpha, November. Kilo 6, Alpha, Alpha, November. Mike in California, just checking in.
And Mike, got you in. Kilo 6, Alpha, Alpha, November. And this object that they believe they've found, located, it's referred to as a trans-Neptunian object. And it's going by the name, so far, as 2017-OF201. And it might be just big enough to fit into a category of a dwarf planet, something like Pluto. But it also might be much larger than Pluto. And this was, this study was produced by the Institute of Advanced Study. And the International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center has also confirmed the discovery about a week ago. And that confirmation gives a little bit more credibility to the previous sighting of it. And what's so interesting about the find is, other than the fact it's apparently there, is that the outer regions of the solar system, once you get past Neptune, it seems to have more going on there than once thought. And this is reminiscent of the suggestion, as I mentioned a few moments ago, about a Planet 9 may exist out past Neptune, where the gravitational influence affects trans-Neptunian objects. So, not Neptune itself, but these objects out there, they affect these trans-Neptunian objects, like rocky debris and smaller dwarf-like planets. Just dropping. And the object, it resides more than 1,600 times Earth distance from the Sun, or about 1,600 astronomical units at helium. Perihelion, with the closest distance, is only about 45.5 times that of Earth's orbit around the Sun. And so that's very similar to Pluto. And no one knows for certain how the object got there. Some speculation that it may have gotten ejected into the Oort cloud and then sent back. The Oort cloud, you have the Kuiper Belt, and after that, the Oort cloud. So it may have got ejected into there and then pulled back in. The recent find could also challenge the Planet 9 hypothesis, because it isn't part of the known cluster of objects that cluster in certain orientations. So these clusters have strange properties, particularly in that they have different angles than the solar system planets, meaning their orbital angles and their trajectories. And this might not be the only object at the outermost region of the solar system that could rival the size of Pluto. There could be hundreds of these. The Kuiper Belt, it's just a little past the Neptune's orbit. And you've got dwarf planets, comets, and other planetary fragments in there. And then you have the Oort cloud, and that's further out. That's outside again. And again, you can have asteroids there. You can have small planets, even some comets originating from there as well. But there could be much more going on there than they previously thought. There may be some dwarf planets, maybe something even much larger there that they can't find as of yet. And this is VHVCAT. Ken here, from the Science and Tech Net, transmitting from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And we're here each week, about my local time here, 9 p.m. or 0100 hours GMT. Varying stations out there, if you'd like to join us, if you have a comment, come on in.
Can
you
go through your
CRSRIO, check
it in?
Hi, Eugene, VHVSSR. I've got you checked in. And this is VH3KEN. And I'm just going to jump to another one, unrelated to space. I'm going to get back into space in a moment, but I just want to put this one out here before I go any further. And I spoke about this one about a week back, too. Archaeopteryx, one of the first of the flying birds. It was a transition between birds and dinosaurs. And as I say on some of the science nets when it comes to dinosaurs, they're almost on a weekly basis finding something new. About specimens and species that they didn't know in the past. And this one here, it's one of the, this recent study about this particular Archaeopteryx, it's one of the most well-preserved fossil specimens of that particular species. If there are any stations out there you'd like to join us, if you have a comment, come on in, and then I'll touch on this one. And then right after this, I'll jump back into a little bit more about space and extraterrestrial life. And I like covering that each week because there's always something new coming up. And we'll get into that just after this one. So this is one of the most well-preserved fossil specimens of the Archaeopteryx. And the animal, as I mentioned, it links modern birds to the dinosaurs. And the interesting thing about this is it's often referred to as a fossil that confirmed Darwin as being right about evolution. And the first remains were found approximately 160 years ago. Just dropping. But this new fossil is completely outstanding in comparison. And it's referred to as the Chicago Archaeopteryx. And the findings were published in the journal Nature. And this particular specimen was put on display in 2024 at the Field Museum. The Field Museum is in Chicago. And gave the public a good look at one of the most complete Archaeopteryx fossils ever discovered. And it was found in Germany. And it was in a private hands before 1990. In 2022, it was finally delivered to the Field Museum. And the remains were so well-preserved that scientists were able to learn a huge amount from it. And it's the smallest known Archaeopteryx. It was only still about as tall as a pigeon. And the bones were encased in the really, really hard limestone. And that's what made extraction really, really difficult. Just dropping. And the process took over a year to complete. And the research team, utilized UV. UV light to avoid harming the really soft tissue that was still there, and use CT scans to guide them during the extraction. And the CT allowed them to know that the bones were precisely 3.2 millimeters or 0.1 inches below the rock surface. In fact, this specimen is the first to be completely CT scanned. Now, the UV light let the scientists find soft tissue, not in the same context as, you know, you squeeze your hand and the soft tissue on the back of your hand, but remnants of the soft tissue. And that glowed under that type of UV light. And there seems to be something in the chemicals where the fossils were first located that makes them glow. So findings helped scientists get answers about its skull, hands, feet, wings, and bones on the roof of its mouth gave them answers on how the cranial kinesis evolved. And in modern birds, this is an area in the beak that moves independently from the brain case. And preserved foot and hand tissue suggests the animal walked on the ground and possibly climbed trees. And the animal is likely the earliest known dinosaur to utilize features of flying. Additional soft tissues were found alongside the entire skeleton. And for it to be able to fly, it would need upper arm feathers. They're called tertials. And because of Archaeopteryx's large upper arm bone, there's a gap in the wing surface. It could have been an issue for flight. Modern birds have a shorter upper arm bone and specialized tertial feathers. And the fossil specimen turns out to have had long tertial feathers, something not seen in its ancestors. And this strongly suggests the animals could fly. In fact, it's evidence that dinosaurs evolved flight several times in the past, but this is the first time it was confirmed that actually could probably had sustained flight. And this is the A3 Cat, Ken here, and you're listening to Science and TechNet. And if you'd like to join us, come on in. You have a comment, come on in. And then the next topic here for tonight is extraterrestrial life and how scientists are looking for it. If you'd like to join us, come on in. And what made me think to include this one? I was at a function a week ago, Saturday. Club members from Skywide had met for a barbecue, and we got talking with one of the members there, and we're talking about the search for life in space, and would we actually even recognize life, even more specifically advanced life that may have developed and evolved so much differently than life here on Earth, and might not recognize it as being life, let alone intelligent life. But anyway, this next one, extraterrestrial life and how scientists are looking for it. If you'd like to join us, come on in, have a comment, come on in, and then I'll press on with this one. And as scientists are finding more and more about exoplanets, and they're discovering more about these, they're optimistic that some may harbor life. So far, there hasn't been any conclusive evidence for life on any other world, regardless of its complexity. So far, the search has included, listening for signals from alien species. This started up in the early 1960s, first with Project OSMA, then after that, SETI. And research on Mars indicates that it might have had life at one point, likely in the form of a bacteria, but this is uncertain. It could have been something more, they don't know. Jupiter. Probes that have been sent to Jupiter have shown that its moon, Europa, it's got an ocean, and maybe hydrothermal vents. In fact, scientists believe that these vents on Earth are where life first evolved. Just drop in. And I'll stop here and mention, too, volcanoes. Volcanoes, after they erupt, very often, very shortly after they erupt, show very large colonization of bacteria. Mount St. Helens is an example of that. After Mount St. Helens erupted, they actually found a new species of bacteria. It was an evolution of one of the bacteria that was commonly found in soil, but it was a different species of that, so it evolved during that time of the eruption. So going back to hydrothermal vents on Earth, hydrothermal vents on other planets could be a place where bacteria might find it an easy place to evolve. And scientists have determined that there's a specific distance around a star where liquid water can exist. That's the Goldilocks zone. This zone is considered conducive for life, at least life as we know it. However, research can only go by what we know about life here on Earth. And the Goldilocks zone might be very different for other life forms. In fact, other life forms might not even be based on carbon. It could be something else like silicon. And in fact, silicon's not all that different from carbon in the way it's structured and latticed. But the oldest known life on Earth that goes back to 4.2 billion years ago. So going by this, life has had plenty of time to evolve to some level in the universe. It seems, at least to me, implausible that life doesn't exist somewhere in the universe. Consider there are about 100 billion stars in the Milky Way, and at the very least, 2 trillion galaxies in the universe that science could study. Most stars are thought to have had at least one orbiting star, and there could be over 20 billion trillion extraterrestrial worlds beyond Earth, or beyond our solar system. And going by all that, it would be mind-boggling if only one planet in all of existence has life. The odds of no other life in the universe is arguably very small. In our solar system, Jupiter and Saturn's moon have water, so life could be there, even if it's just bacteria. On some really weird creatures who live around hydrothermal vents on Earth, or some even look like some of the bizarre-looking fish that at extreme ocean depths here on our planet. So, going back, looking at the timeline of our planet, Earth formed over 4.5 billion years ago and remained devoid of life for a very long time. Then around 3.7 billion years ago, carbon-producing microbes evolved. It wasn't until about 2.7 and 1.8 billion years that the type of cells that eventually produced complex life came into being. Multicellular life didn't start until around 600 million years ago. Human beings started up around 300,000 years ago, and when I'm talking human beings, anatomically modern human beings, as opposed to hominids. Hominids emerged around 85 million years ago, but anatomically modern humans, about 300,000 years ago. Stopping. And if there are other planets with Earth-like conditions, this means the timeline for intelligent life to form from primitive forms is pretty brief. Scientists don't know for sure, but life on other worlds may be driven by some form of evolution leading to increasingly complex life forms. So if a planet went through the same geologic changes as Earth, it's likely complex life formed there over some period of time. And we may not need to look beyond our own solar system to find life at some level. Jupiter's moon, Ganymede, which is the largest moon, it's got a giant hidden ocean under an ice-covered surface. Europa, another moon of Jupiter, it's got an icy ocean where liquid water exists by heat generated by the pull of Jupiter's gravity. In addition, the chemical building blocks of life have also been found there. Enceladus, this is a Saturn moon. It's constantly producing water vapor that contains carbon compounds. And where carbon compounds exist, there's a chance of finding life. Hydrogen cyanide is one such chemical, and it's essential for life, or at least for complex life to evolve, at least here on Earth. Titan, which is another Saturn moon, has a carbon-rich surface of liquid. Any life there would possibly exist as an extremophile, like those on Earth around hydrothermal vents. And another moon you might not have expected for potential life is Neptune's moon, Triton. It's got it's geologically reactive in the form of geysers that erupt when the surface nitrogen gets heated by the sun. And Mars also might have life, but probably microbial. But that's not to say that more complex life didn't exist there billions of years ago. And looking for life at different levels and complexity, there's all kinds of possibilities for that. SETI, which is a passive search, listens for radio signals from extraterrestrials beyond our solar system. And this is assuming that an extraterrestrial civilization developed along the lines we did. Radio waves and different technologies that leak into space. For life less advanced, scientists look for molecules that are produced by life, biosignatures. And this, of course, is probes that are sent to places like Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn looking for any telltale signs of life. In 2028, a probe, a dragonfly, will be sent to Saturn's moon Titan and should reach it by 2034. And now this brings us to UFOs. And almost done with this one. UFOs and sightings. Sightings for these go back to, at least modern sightings, go back to 1947. And that started the modern UFO interest with a sighting. It was by Kenneth Arnold. He was a private pilot, and he spotted some disc-like objects over Mount Rainier in Washington. This is June 24th, 1947. And that was actually the beginning of the interest in the UFO flap that was going on, and also gave the name flying saucers, because at first when he was looking at them, they appeared to be like skipping across water like a disc would. And then there was the Roswell incident in New Mexico in 1947. That's persisted to this day, still unsolved. The leading theory for that is an experimental balloon that they were using back then. It was top secret to pick up nuclear explosions from the Soviet Union, so a nuclear explosion detector. And more recently, there's been some intriguing videos out there from jet fighters that have shown UAPs performing some really strange maneuvers. And our closest exoplanet that has conditions for life is Proxima Centauri B. And with present technology, it would take about 6,300 years for a spacecraft to reach it from here. An alien civilization would need technology and an understanding of physics that greatly exceed ours to be able to reach interstellar objects. So for the time being, some UAPs, UFOs, are just that, unidentified aerial phenomena. And with that then, this is VH3KX. And if there are any stations out there, if you'd like to join us, you have a comment, come on in. And then right after this, another one, Mega Constellation. And concerning radiation being given off from these and how it's interfering with astronomy. Any comments or check-ins, come on in. This is VH3KX, Ken here. This is the Science and Tech Net.
VK2, Bravo, India, Oscar. My name is Mike, checking in from Nowra, Australia.
And I've got you checked in. Thanks for joining us.
Victor Echo 1, Charlie Mike Delta, Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia, Canada. First name is Corey here. Not sure what you guys are doing, but we're going to listen along. Over.
And Corey, this is VH3CAX, and you've tuned in to Science and Tech. Now, we're here each week, 9 p.m., my local time here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. That's 100 hours GMT. We're here each week, so that's where you are right now. If you want to come in at some point, you have a comment, feel free. And this next one, I mentioned about mega constellation, and there's more and more concern being generated by the amount of radiation being produced by these. So, radio waves, they're constantly being emitted by these satellites. And for comparison, if our eyes were sensitive enough to detect them, the sky would be full of very bright spots and constant flashing. And this RF, it obscures distant signals beyond low Earth orbit. So at some point, there will be an inflection point where a ground-based astronomy could become blind to the radio spectrum coming from deep space. So radio astronomy from Earth at that point would be impossible from the planet. We'd have to be looking at other means, getting more of these space-based telescopes out into space. More on that in a few minutes, too. Radio astronomy, it allows scientists to detect the universe beyond what is possible in optical light. It allows the detection of near asteroids, let's say jets from supermassive black holes, fast radio pulses, and the search for alien life. And the radio segment of the electromagnetic spectrum goes from somewhere around 3 kilohertz beyond 300 gigahertz. Drop it. So that translates into wavelengths from somewhere more than 60 miles, 1,000 kilometers, to 0.04 inches, about 1 millimeter long. And scientists they're typically looking at in signals between 1 megahertz and 100 gigahertz. And specific research from these mega constellations was and is still being performed with the British Astronomical Association. And the largest Earth-based radio scopes use an even more narrow range. Unfortunately, these signals are being increasingly interfered with by a bombardment from Starlink and other satellites. The search for extraterrestrial light, the frequency for that is around 1420 to about 1720 megahertz, and that's referred to as the waterhole frequency because that's a very quiet zone as far as radio noise in space. So if someone's going to be sending a signal, you look for some sort of aberration within that frequency range. Just drop it. In 2023, a report came out from the International Astronomical Union, and this was created for the Center of for Protection of Dark and Quiet Sky from Satellite Constellation Interference. We'll just refer to that as CPS. And stated that Generation 1 Starlink satellites were leaking UEMR, so that's unintentional electromagnetic radiation, at a much higher rate than other spacecraft, and frequency ranged from 110 to 180 megahertz. In Europe's low frequency array, LOFAR, scans at 10 to 240 megahertz. That's used for looking for pulsars, solar wind, cosmic rays, and searching for sort of galaxies from the point of time of the reionization of the universe. In 2024, just happened. In 2024, there's a study, it was a follow-up to LOFAR regarding the newer Generation 2 Starlink satellites, which are still up there. And they were linking over 30 times more UEMR than predecessors. Generation 2 produces RF 10 million times brighter than the faintest radio visible objects in the sky. And that's kind of a rough analogy, too, if you're looking at a full moon with a naked eye, while trying to find some really, really faint stars very close by to it. So that's kind of a rough analogy for that. And as of May, there are around 11,700 active satellites orbiting the planet. 7,300 of these are Starlink, which have been in existence since 2019. And there was a research report written up by Jonathan McDowell, an astronomer at Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And estimates say that by 2050, there could be up to 100,000 private satellites in low Earth orbit. And it's right here where things start to get dicey. And at that number, an inflection point is likely reached, where ground-based radio astronomy is no longer possible. And once you hit this 100,000 mark and get past it, as I mentioned earlier, you're also now starting to see huge amounts of collisions from an overcrowded space, place in space there where all these satellites are trying to reside. And this is VA3KX, and this is the Science and TechNet, and I'm transmitting from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. If you'd like to join us, you have a comment, come on in, and then we'll push on to another one here. And this one's about COVID. Then after this, I'll a few more things about space before we end things here this evening. So if you'd like to join us, come on in. You have a comment, come on in. And then a new variant out there, NB 1.8.1. And the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, it's determined that there's a surge of COVID cases. There's been a surge of COVID cases in China. And they've determined this surge is due to a new variant. It's NB 1.8.1. The U.S. Has recently reported cases originating mainly from international travelers arriving in California, Washington State, Virginia, and New York area. And as far as Canada, I don't believe there's any reported here in Canada yet. That will probably change, but as of May 31st, I think it was, nothing's been reported here. Sequencing details. Sequencing details for the virus were published in the Global Initiative on Sharing All Influenza Data, the virus database. And cases have been found in Japan, South Korea, France, Netherlands, Spain, Vietnam, China, Taiwan. Testing took place for those places April 22nd through to May 12th. And the variant is the present dominant form of COVID-19 in China, where there is a significant rise in emergency room visits and hospitalizations. Authorities in China have now started to urge residents to mask in public, even though there is no evidence that this particular variant is more severe than others. In Taiwan has reported a rise in emergency room visits, severe cases, and even death. Health authorities are stockpiling vaccines and antiviral medications to try and deal with an epidemic wave. So far, So far, research says that ND 1.8.1 is not any better at evading the immune system compared to other strains that are present rising. However, it does seem to be better able to bind to human cells, and this means that it could be more transmissible. Last season, vaccines were used against JN.1. That was also referred to as KP.2. Both Pfizer and Moderna are thinking of switching to a different vaccine targeting a different JN.1 variant, and that's referred to as LP8.1, which could boost immunity against NB1.8.1. And evolution of COVID-19, it's been unpredictable. No one knows when or if a more severe form of it will emerge. So it's very very unpredictable. And I think the NB1.8.1, I think it was a derivative of XDV 1.5.1, if I'm not mistaken. I may be mistaken on this, but it was a derivative of XDV 1.5.1. So the point of that report on COVID is it's here, it's not going anywhere, and like earlier on predictions, they felt that it's going to be evolving something like the flu. The flu has been here for a very, very long time. It's been evolving. COVID will probably do the same sort of thing, and we'll have to deal with it almost like that on a seasonal basis, the same as the flu. The great flu pandemic, 1918. Every flu variant from that point in time is what we have now. So what we have now is a lineage from that time. So the flu is here. That's not going away anytime soon either. And this is VH3CAN. And this is the Science and TechNet, and transmitting from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. If any station out there, if you'd like to join us, come on in. And move on to another one, the Dire Wolf. We talked about this. It was a company that had said the Colossal Biosciences said they brought back from extinction the Dire Wolf. A little bit more about that in a moment. This is VH3K. If you'd like to join us, come on in. Now, a comment, come on in for that as well. And going back to April, specifically April 7th, the biotechnology company, this was Colossal Biosciences, they announced it brought dire wolves back from extinction. And they stated it was the rebirth of an extinct dire wolf. The chief scientist has now explained that those animals weren't really dire wolves. There were three snowy wolves, and they were given names of Khaleesi, Romulus, and Remus. And actually, it made headlines when a company claimed that they were the world's first de-extincted dire wolves. And researchers were quick to criticize the claim, as at the time they said it was misleading that the wolves were just genetically modified gray wolves. In a new interview, Colossus Chief Science Officer Beth Shapiro has confirmed that the dire wolves are indeed just gray wolves with 20 modified genes. But this is where it gets interesting, a little bit more in the report here, and what that signifies with the 20 modified genes. So she went on to say, and this is a direct quote from her, "It's not possible to bring something back that is identical to a species used to be alive. Our animals are gray wolves with 20 edits that are cloned." And we said that from the very beginning. So Shapiro's latest comment isn't it doesn't deviate significantly from what she and the company have said previously. And she also went on to say, "We chose to call them dire wolves because they look like dire wolves and reflect the key traits we found in sequencing their genomes." Part of the controversy comes from there being lots of different definitions for a species. Shapiro previously said they're using the morphological species concept, which means defining a species based on morphology, or basically to appearance. However, the vast majority of scientists work from the biological species concept, which means a group of organisms capable of interbreeding and producing fertile offspring. So that's how you define a species. That means while animals in the same species may look the same, their appearance doesn't define them as a species. Stop it. In the case of the dire wolf, it went extinct more than, 10,000 years ago. Researchers haven't seen one. When the colossal showed its wolves, they released a statement and some other documents and posts and even some videos that presented the animals as dire wolves, not genetically modified gray wolves. The company explained how it had edited the genes of gray wolves and detailed the process was the birth of a once extinct dire wolf, not a modified gray wolf. So just another quick quote here from the company, and then this is where some discrepancy comes in. It went on to say, in our press release, we stated we made 20 gene edits to gray wolf cells. Gray wolves are the closest living relative to dire wolves, as we showed in our paper. With those edits, we have brought back the dire wolf. We've also said the species are ultimately a human construct, and that other scientists have the right to disagree and call them whatever they want, et cetera, et cetera. Well, genetically modifying a wolf has a long, complicated process, but colossal, they only made 20 tweaks to 14 gray wolf genes, changing traits like hair color, body size. However, while the two species share a lot of the same DNA, there are a lot of genetic differences between them. So colossal has said the gray wolf and the dire wolf genomes are 99.5% identical. But that means is that there's still a 12,235,000 individual differences in the genes that are still there. And so this was a conclusion. Nick Lawrence, he's a paleogeneticist and associate professor at the University of Otago in New Zealand, just recently said. And a quote from him, so a gray wolf with 20 edits to 14 genes, even if these are key differences, is still very much a gray wolf. So colossal, by a definition from other scientists and looking at the genes here and the amount of editing and what that means as far as remaining differences, is that there's 12,235,000 individual differences. So by all accounts, it's not a dire wolf. The gray wolf may have resemblance to a dire wolf, but it's still not a dire wolf. And this is VH3CAS, Ken here, the Science and Tech Net. If you'd like to join us, if you have a comment, come on in. We're here each Saturday coming to you from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. I start then at my local time here, 9 p.m., 0100 hours GMT. If you'd like to join us, if you have a comment, come on in. And pardon me. This next one here, got a couple more in space, but there's a few others I'm going to present first here before we get a CREST VE3RWJ sent one in. I went through the research reports on this, and I wrote this one up later this afternoon, so I think you might find this interesting too. It's about a Cooper's hawk, and something very intriguing they discovered about this animal. Vladimir Dinis, he was apparently just driving his daughter to school. When he saw a Cooper's hawk, it was a young Cooper's hawk. It came darting over out of a tree. It swooped out of a tree. It came diving down low to the ground, and it followed along a line of cars. And then right after that, it dove to a nearby front yard. He's a zoologist at the University of Tennessee, and he specializes in animal behavior and intelligence. And he then watched the exact same scenario play out a few days later. And he realized something scientifically interesting was probably happening at this point. The birds seemed to understand that whenever a person pushed the pedestrian crossing signal, the light there, a long line of cars would back up down the street. And the bird then used the vehicles for a means to attack a group of unsuspecting birds in a nearby front yard. And this was published Thursday in the journal Frontiers of Ethology. And Dinis observed the hawk for 12 total hours over the course of 18 weekday mornings in a neighborhood of West Orange, New Jersey. during the winter of 2021 to 2022. Stopping. He watched the bird as it attacked. It was six attacks on the prey. It was a flock of these birds. So it watched as it attacked these birds. And he couldn't see how many of the hunts were successful out of those six attacks. On one occasion, he did see the hawk fly away the sparrow, gripped in its feet. And on another, he saw the hawk actually eating a dove on the ground. After two attacks, he got a pretty good idea of what was happening. First, when someone would push the signal crossing, that would activate a loud clicking sound, and it's designed to let people who have visual impairments know when it's safe to cross the street. The noise also served as a cue for the hawk, which would fly to a nearby tree, and it would just sit on a low branch. And as cars began stopping behind the crosswalk, the hawk waited. And once the line got long enough, and that was usually about 10 cars, the bird swooped down, flew just a feet above the sidewalk, along the line of vehicles. And once it reached a certain house, it made a 90-degree turn and veered in the yard across the street where the birds were feeding on the ground. And the hawk understood. It understood the connection between the crossing, the pedestrian crossing sound, and the eventual slowing down and stopping of the cars and the length of the cars. And the bird also had to have a good mental map of the place, because when the car line reached the tree, the raptor couldn't any longer see the place where its prey had been, so it had to be a memory. It had to remember exactly where it was in relation to the lineup of cars. And the bird also learned this behavior at a young age, at a time when other Cooper hawks are just not good at hunting yet. And this is an opinion from a biologist of environment and climate change in Canada, and wasn't involved with this study. But Cooper hawks, they're super skilled predators, but sometimes they die of starvation if they can't find enough food. Other birds have been observed taking advantage of the human environment. Urban crows, for instance, have been spotted dropping nuts in their traffic, letting cars run over them, cracking open the shells so they can get the stuff inside, stopping. Pigeons, they'll sometimes wait around for humans to turn on drinking fountains so they can get at the water. And swains and hawks have also been known to fall behind tractors and other farm equipment and nab insects and other things that are getting flushed out. But cities are different environments for birds of prey. They kind of avoid a lot of things. They have to avoid windows, cars, overhead wires, and a whole host of things while they're out hunting around for food. And scientists have more often studied intelligence in birds, like parrots, for instance, and crows, rather than in hawks, like these raptors. But that's now starting to take on a different atmosphere. Papers like this one are starting to call more attention to raptor intelligence. So it goes to show that, again, when it comes to animal intelligence, there's a lot they've been learning over the last 10 years. It's almost at an exponential rate what they're finding out about animals now. And as I said earlier, it seems to be less and less that's separating us from the rest of the animals, particularly when it comes to reasoning, like intelligence, decision-making, things like this. Other animals out there also use tools, chimpanzees, even insects. So things that define us as human beings tend to overlap into the other areas of the animal kingdom. And this is VH3KX, and I've got time for two more here for tonight before we tie the ribbon. This is VH3KX. If you have a comment or you'd like to join us, come on in. This is VH3KX, Ken, and you're listening to Science and TechNet. And a little bit on space here, one more on space, and then another about computers, in fact, in this case, artificial intelligence. This one about Jupiter, and it's shrinking. Well, no big surprise there, but it used to be about twice its present size. Early on in the evolution and development of the solar system, there was this huge primordial cloud of gas and dust that slowly collapsed and condensed into the planets and things that remain from that ended up in the asteroid belt, the Kuiper belt, in Oort's cloud. But this cloud of gas and dust, that's what the sun and all the planets are formed from, that dissipated about 4.5 billion years ago. So that congealed into what we have now around us, the sun and the planets. And at that time, Jupiter was twice its current size, and its magnetic field was about 50 times stronger. And the findings described in a study published May 20th in the journal Nature Astronomy could help scientists develop a clear picture of the early solar system. And Jupiter, Jupiter's huge gravity along with the sun helped build the solar system. It shaped the orbits of other planets and rocky bodies, but how the planet itself formed to this day still remains unclear. Drop it.